Been a lot of players that have been working behind the scenes since January. They've been lifting weights, they've been running, and as coaches, we always emphasize, we always know that the foundation that wins that championship in the fall is built in February. It's built in March. It's built during the off season. While some of the athletes, some of the football players have been working alone, most of the football players today work in groups and work as a team. As coach several years ago, I observed that the strongest football players that we had from the offseason, the ones that were in the best condition when they reported back in the fall, were the ones that had come and worked with the team during the offseason. They had a much more consistent work schedule, and they worked harder than those who worked alone. There are a few exceptions today, but not many. As a rule, a team has stronger, better conditioned, and faster athletes when those athletes work together as a team in the offseason. Colleges now know that. All the colleges expect their players to work at strength and conditioning 12 months out of the year. Almost all college players voluntarily stay on campus during the summer to work as a part of the team, so they're there year-round. They may get to go home a few weeks, but for the most part, they're on campus year-round working. They become a stronger player through being a part of a stronger team. Now, as fans of, and I'm afraid I may leave somebody out, but I hope not, but as fans of Alabama and Auburn and Georgia and Florida, Mississippi State and Texas Tech and Miami, we would not tolerate a head coach that did not place a priority on strength and conditioning. We would not allow that to happen. Reason for that is because a large part of the chances of victory rest in the strength of the athletes and the conditioning of the athletes. A successful team is greater than the sum of its parts. And we see teamwork around us everywhere. It's evident in all aspects of our lives, not only on a playing field, but it's evident at the office, where most of us work. Is evident when you pick a couch up and move it. And it's evident at home in raising children. Humans are social animals, and civilization is a result of a pooled effort. That's why God said in Genesis 2:18 that it's not good for man to be alone. And he made Eve for Adam. First family was God's idea. Families are prime examples of the value of teamwork. The whole of a strong family is greater than the sum of the parts of the family. The whole keeps each of us, or the whole helps each of us become stronger. No doubt many of us here tonight have the strength that we have today in our faith because we grew up as a part of a strong family. Probably not everybody, but many of us have benefited from the influence of a strong Christian family as we were growing up. As I've said before, I've been strengthened by my family in the past, beginning with my grandparents' generation. If my grandparents hadn't been as faithful as they were to the church, I wonder where my parents would have been. I benefited from the faith of my parents. My grandparents hadn't been as strong as they were, and my parents weren't as faithful as they were. I wonder where I would be. I benefited from Frida's strength of faith. And I wonder if she hadn't been as strong as she is, where would I be now? I benefited from my son's generation. They've challenged me, and I've grown stronger because of their strength. I benefited from my grandson's generation. That's a lot of generations. Although they're young, they keep in front of me a challenge to remain faithful, to help strengthen them. So my faith is a direct result of the strength of my family down through several generations. We can be strengthened individually by a strong family group. There are three questions tonight that I'd like to answer regarding the value of the role of the family in strengthening the faith of its members. I don't think there's any doubt that the family strengthens us, but how does it go about doing it? What it, What is God's will for the family? What's the role of the family? First off, the first question I wanted to ask is, can the family make a difference in the strength of faith of its members? I think it can, but let's look and see what God wants us to do. We don't have to look too far to find an answer to that question. What I just gave you is my opinion, and my opinion may be right, it may be wrong. But let's go to two sources, and really we only need to go to one source, but we'll look at two. The first source I want to look at is the Bible. What does God want us to do? What does God want the family to do? And we don't have to look very far in the Bible to understand exactly how much God appreciated the importance of the family in strengthening its members to follow Him. The family is a critical element in God's grand plan to redeem man. There are many Bible passages we could study, and that's one of the problems I've had in trying to put this together. We couldn't cover them all tonight, and so I've really struggled trying to whittle these down to the few that we can get in and study properly within this short period of time. So I've chosen just a few to read, knowing that there are many others out there. So if you would, please follow along with me in your Bible. Let's start in the book of Genesis, and let's go to chapter 18. And this is going to be more like a Sunday school class than it is a sermon, and that's the way I feel most comfortable anyway. So let's look at verses 17 through 19, if you would, in Genesis 18. And this is a case where Abraham has been visited by the three men that are on their way to Sodom and Gomorrah, and they're about to leave. And starting in verse 16, actually, let's read that. Then the men rose up from there and looked down towards Sodom. And Abraham was walking with them to send them off. This is after they had eaten. And the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham, what I am about to do, since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed? For I have chosen him in order that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord, by doing righteousness and justice, in order that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him." I think it's pretty evident here that that God had a plan for Abraham to strengthen his family, the family that God was going to use to bless many nations. It was going to come through Abraham's household. And the way that the burden was on Abraham here, that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord. Pretty plain what God's plan is there. He's using the family. He's using the man in the family to strengthen the members of that family in the generations to come. Let's go on over to the book of Deuteronomy next. Deuteronomy, the sixth chapter, is a passage that we know very well. And God demonstrated his appreciation of the value of the family when he instructed Moses to instruct the Israelites about the function of the family. These are Moses' final words. He will be dying pretty soon at the end of the book of Deuteronomy. And Moses is reviewing everything. This is his final exam review before he leaves the Israelites, and they're going to be on their own. And pretty important to listen to a famous man's last words. And Moses was a pretty famous man, pretty wise man, speaking for God. And I think we need to pay pretty close attention to his last words. In God's plan, the family had the primary responsibility for nurturing faith. Let's look at Deuteronomy 6, and let's start in verse 4. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all of your might. And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your sons and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. And you shall bind them as a sign on your hand that they shall be as frontals on your forehead. And you shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates." Let's go on over and read verses 20 through 25 there also in chapter 6. When your son asks you in a time to come, saying, what do the testimonies and the statutes and the judgments mean which the Lord commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us up from Egypt with a mighty hand. Moreover, the Lord showed great and distressing signs and wonders before our eyes against Egypt, Pharaoh and all of his household. And he brought us out from there in order to bring us in, to give us the land which he had sworn to our fathers. So the Lord commanded us to observe all of these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always and for our survival as it is today. And it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all this commandment before the Lord our God just commanded us. We're to answer those questions. We're to teach, and we're to answer those questions when our children ask us about, why do we do this at church? Why do we partake the Lord's Supper? What does that mean? What did Mr. Sargent mean in the sermon today when he said this? And we're to be ready to answer those questions and to give a reason to our children. Let's go over to Deuteronomy 32, and let's read verses 46 through 47. This is getting really close to the end. And Moses, I'll start in verse 45. When Moses had finished speaking all these words to all Israel, he said to them, take to your heart all the words which I am warning you today, which you shall command your sons to observe carefully, even all the words of this law. And verse 47 is where I wanted to put the emphasis. We don't just need to command our children or teach our children God's commands, but we need to teach them verse 47 also. For it is not an idle word for you. Indeed, it is your life. And by this word, you shall prolong your days in the land which you're about to cross the Jordan to possess. We're not just to teach our children, teach our families commands that may or may not mean a lot in and of themselves, but we're to teach them that these are not just idle words. This is your life. This is the way you live. This is what you put into action every day. We're to help them develop a biblical worldview and to understand God's active part in our lives. Not an easy job. Pretty daunting task. One I hope that I have been up to and will continue to be up to. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 7. And I think God gives us another side of the family's role when he comes at it from a negative way. Look at Deuteronomy 7. Let's start in verse 3. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughter, speaking of the people that remain in the land. I'm sorry, I meant to clarify that. In verses 1 and 2, he talks about the people that would be in the promised land, the pagan nations. And God goes on to say, furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take your daughters, take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you. But thus you shall do to them. You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and hew down their asherim and burn their graven images with fire. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. This is not the only place God says this. He says this many times in the Pentateuch and over in Joshua. And other places, but they were warned about intermarrying with the people of the land. Why? Because they would become a family with those people. And once that religion got into their family, very real danger that it could turn them away from God. God recognized the power of the family. There's no doubt he recognized the power of the family to strengthen people to follow him or to turn people away from him. We need to appreciate that power also. Probably the greatest exhibition of faith that God shows as far as his faith and the power to strengthen its members is when he allowed his only son to be born into a family here on earth. Christ could have come any way he wanted to, any way God wanted him to. God chose for him to be born into a family. Born into the family of Joseph and Mary, a family where everything wasn't just right at that time, and a family where they had to work out a few problems. The fate of mankind hung in the balance. Apparently, God had a lot of faith in the ability of the family to strengthen its members. He entrusted Jesus to Joseph and Mary and their family to be raised properly. That's confidence. That's a lot of confidence. Luke, the doctor, tells us in Luke 2:52 that under the guidance of Mary and Joseph, that and in the support system of their family, that Jesus grew physically, he grew intellectually, he grew socially, and he grew spiritually. Jesus was strengthened in the family of Mary and Joseph. Jesus grew stronger in a strong family. God's child grew stronger in a strong family. Our children will grow stronger in a strong family. I don't know of anything that could be more convincing that I could say, anybody else could say, regarding God's appreciation of and faith in the family than that fact right there. Could anything stronger be said regarding God's desires for our families today? It appears that God knows that the most important influence in shaping the religious lives of young people is a religious life modeled and taught to them at home by the parents every day. The Bible's pretty clear, I believe, on that. And there are many other passages on over into the New Testament we could look at, but let's move on. What are our families doing today? If we look around at the effect that families are having on people today, what effect are families having an effect on their members? That's what God wants us to do, but do families really have an effect today? A lot of people are critical of the family and say that the family's outdated and outmoded, and a lot of sociologists think that it needs to be, you know, we don't need it anymore. It's run its course. There's a couple studies that I want to mention to you. One study was conducted several years ago by three Abilene Christian University professors. And they surveyed 2,300 teenagers from Church of Christ, Churches of Christ across the nation. And these teenagers were in high school. Some of them were in high school. Some of them attended five of Christian universities. 88% of the teenagers said that their parents were either somewhat or very influential on their beliefs. That says a lot right there, that 88% said they were very, or somewhat, or very influential. 92% of the teens expressed some level of identification with their parents' morals. They were buying into what their mom and dad stood for. 92%. It's a big number. Big number. It tells me that parents can have and are having, in our contemporary culture, a positive effect on their children. Another survey conducted, and this was across Protestant denominations, about six different denominations. The Search Institute questioned teenagers to determine the factors that influence teens in their faith. What factor had the biggest influence over you? The most significant religious influence for Christian teens today is mama. Mama. Sorry, dads. Sorry, youth ministers. Sorry, David. Sorry, elders. It's mama. The second most significant influence for Christian teens today is daddy. The third most significant influence for teenagers is a grandparent. This was over 11,000 teenagers across the nation that were questioned. Mom and dad were found to be 2 to 3 times more influential than any church program. Any church program. Now, Guys, let's don't mistake that on a practical basis, the home is the primary place where faith is nurtured. When faith is in the home, everybody catches it. We need to be equipping our families and motivating our families to teach God's word faithfully in a place where the most influence can be done. Many other studies have been conducted. The overwhelming conclusion to all of these studies is that the most important influence in shaping the religious lives of young people is the religious life modeled and taught to them by their parents. Okay? And we can conclude that the family can be effective in the process of strengthening its members. We can go one step further and say the family should be effective in strengthening the faith of its members. We can go even one step further and say that the family must be effective in strengthening the faith of its members. But the critical factor is what takes place in the home. The moral, the spiritual, and the relational foundations of most people's lives are determined by age 13. That's what some studies say. We may or may not agree with that. It may be slightly off age 13. But we'll all agree that at a young age, children, basic moral, spiritual, and relational ideas are formed. These factors are primarily shaped by the child's family experiences. Now, this is not to say that people can't be changed. We see that all the time. However, as they age, it is very difficult to change those impressions that were received at an early age. Regardless of how good the Bible school or the youth ministry are at church, if children don't see godly living modeled at home, and if they don't hear issues of values and faith discussed in the home, and if they don't hear the Bible taught in a loving way in the home, it's unlikely that any faith they gain at church will last as they grow older. This is something that we've seen through the years in youth ministry. Jonathan Edwards was a colonial American preacher. Some of you know of him. He was a missionary to the Native Americans. He was a theologian. He's well known for his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. He was the president of the College of New Jersey. Later, that was changed to Princeton University. And he was grandfather of Aaron Burr. Edwards is widely recognized as the most important philosophical theologian in America. During the colonial era, in the 1700s, 1730, somewhere in that area, Edwards said, every Christian family ought to be as if it were a little church, consecrated to Christ and wholly influenced and governed by its rule. Every home ought to be as if it were a little church, purified, set apart for a special purpose to Christ, wholly influenced by Christ, and governed by Christ's rule. That's pretty wise words from a long time ago that still hold true today. Yeah, the family can strengthen its members. There's no doubt about that. So what should the families do to strengthen the faith of its members? Well, again, let's look at two sources. Let's go to the Bible, and I'm running out of time. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Let's look at what God says for us to do to strengthen the faith of our members. Number one, we as parents, we as leaders in the household, need to firm up our passion and a commitment to God. First thing we got to do is get ourselves right. First thing we got to do is get ourselves sold on the program. Look at Deuteronomy 4, verse 9. Only give heed to yourself and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, but make them known to your sons and your grandsons. First off, give heed to yourself, lest you forget. We need to make sure we're right first. Let's go to Deuteronomy 6, verse 6 again. It starts off there, and these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. Before you teach them to your children, they got to be on your heart. Let's go to Joshua 23. Let's look at verse 11. In Joshua 23, 11, he tells them, take diligent heed to yourselves to love God. Before he gets over to make a choice statement, take diligent heed to yourselves to love God. We need to make sure we love God. And then we get to Joshua 24, verse 15. And if it's disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're living. But as for me, he didn't start with my house, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. We got to make our mind up first. We got to commit ourselves. We got to be passionate about this job that God has given us to do. Well, when we take care of that, what do? Well, you teach God. We teach God. And there's four things that I think we ought to teach about God. And I don't know that they necessarily need to be in this order, but something like this order. I think the first thing we need to do, we need to teach God's love. Let's turn back to Deuteronomy 7. And let's take a look at verse 8. But because the Lord loved you and kept the oath which he swore to your forefathers, the Lord brought you out by a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. We go to Jeremiah, the 31st chapter, and we look at verse 3. Jeremiah says, the Lord appeared to him from afar, saying, I have loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore, I have drawn you with loving kindness. We need to teach God's love. We need to teach his everlasting love. We go to John 3:16. We need to teach that he loved us so much he gave us a gift, his son, Jesus Christ. We could go to 1 John 3:1, Ephesians 2:4-5, numerous verses in the New Testament that we could look at, but we need to teach that he loved us so much. He loved us so much that he allows us to be a part of his family. He adopted us into his family because of his love for us. We need to teach God's love. That's something that younger children can understand. We need to teach his awesome nature. Let's go to Psalm 78 real quick. Psalm 78 is a key psalm in this concept. And I want to start reading in verse 1 and read on down for a ways. Listen, O my people, to my instruction. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. Our fathers have told us. We will not conceal them from their children, but tell to the generation to come the praises of the Lord, his strength, and his wondrous works that he has done. Guys, we need to teach God's awesome nature. We need to go back in the Bible and teach the great things God's done. But not only that, we need to tell our children and teach our children on a very personal basis what he's done for us. We've had prayers answered. We've had situations God has shown his love to us in many ways in our lives. And we need to share that with our children and help them understand God's awesome nature. And it goes on down. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should teach them to their children, that the generation to come might know, even the children yet to be born. My grandfather had no idea about Lincoln and Philip and Brock, as generations that weren't even yet born when they taught me as a child up in Fort Deposit. Verse 7, that... Why? Why should we do this? Critical verses right here, verse 7, that they should put their confidence, their hope in God, that they should not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments and not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not prepare its heart and whose spirit was not faithful to God. We need to teach them God's awesome nature. We could go. We don't have time, but we could go to Psalms 145, verses 4 through 13. And there we can see that when we teach it, we need to be excited about teaching. We need to be fired up about teaching it, not a drudgery. We also need to teach about God's righteous and just nature. They need to understand. Let's go to Psalms 48 and verse 10. Many verses we could look at, but Psalms 48:10 says, "As is thy name, O God, so is thy praise to the ends of the earth. Thy right hand is full of righteousness." We could go to Psalms 137. We could go to Psalms 145:17, Zephaniah 3:5, and there we read that he brings justice to light. Yes, God's a loving God, and he's an awesome God. He's a righteous God, too, and he's a just God. And we need to never forget that, and our children need to know that. Finally, we need to teach his commandments. We read back over, let's go back to Genesis 18, 19. Well, we've already read that, and we saw where Abraham was told to teach those commandments. Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 9, they were told to talk about God's commandments when you're sitting down to eat and when you go to bed at night and when you get up in the morning and when you're walking down the road, you teach God's commandments. And verses 20 through 25, and we learn in 1 John 5, 3 that if we love him, we'll obey him. We need to teach God's commandments. We need to teach the importance of obedience. We need to teach the total picture of God. We need to train our children. Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he's to go. To train means more than just a verbal teaching. It's setting an example. It's modeling. It's disciplining them. And it's teaching them, disciplining them, and modeling to them in their own unique way. Each child has his own way of learning. And we as parents need to be wise and sensitive to that. We also need to teach God by traditions. We're, in Exodus 12, when they talk about the Passover, he was told, when you partake of this Passover in the future, and the children asked you, what are we doing this for? This is weird. Why are we doing this? Well, let me tell you why we're doing it. This is what God did. This is how great God is. He did this on this night. When they crossed the Jordan River, God told Joshua in Joshua 4, take one man from each tribe and tell him to go back in that river and pick up a rock and bring it out, and we're going to build a monument here. And when, in the years to come, when people say, what is that monument? Why is that stack of rocks there? Let me tell you why it's there. Let me tell you what God did on that day. Tell you how great God is. Those traditions are there to teach the Lord's Supper. In 1 Corinthians 11, verses 23 through 28, when our children see us eating a cracker and drinking grape juice, what is that for? What does that mean? Opportunity to teach. Jump all over that tradition and teach. We need to serve. We need to glorify God. When we serve, we glorify God. When we serve together as a family and people see our works, when our light shines and they see our works, then God is glorified. Mark 10, verses 42 through 45, we teach the humility of Christ. When we teach them to serve and we serve right along beside them, great way to teach. We'll fulfill the law of Christ in Galatians 6, verses 2 through 4, and also in verse 10, when we serve and when we teach them how to serve, we're strengthening the faith of our children. Again, we could go back and look, what can we do on a practical daily basis? And I'll hurry through these. Number one, we need to communicate. You can't teach God and his commandments without effective communication. We've got to be available to talk to our kids. We've got to be honest with them. We need to have a relaxed approach. Anxiety, when you're talking to your kids, cuts off communication. There needs to be a relaxed approach. The help that we give them, the information that we pass on to them in our communication, needs to be helpful to them. It needs to be pertinent to their situation. The greatest thing we can do as far as communication is concerned in teaching our children is to listen to them. Listening can be a lot more effective than talking. When parents listen, they're communicating to the child without saying a word that they consider them to be persons of worth. Listening indicates a relationship. Talk about your family history. Show pictures and tell stories. Most children want to know something of importance about their relatives, the people they came from. I don't think we ought to lie, but I think it's kind of cool to make a story funny every now and then, and maybe enhance it a little bit. Give children things to do at home. Give them meaningful jobs to do. Include them in family discussions. Use their ideas if possible, and help them feel like they're part of the process and that they contribute to the family. It's very critical. Help them develop a sense of identity. Help them develop a sense of community. I think we need to have age-appropriate faith-at-home activities. You can call it whatever you want to. That's just one name I thought. As infants, we need to spend time with them. It's critical that that babies have a lot of attention paid to them. Singing to them is a great idea. Even me singing to them is a pretty good idea, as long as it's not too loud. But sing to them. Sing biblical songs to them. At about age 2, start with Bible story devotionals. Age 5, let them start, or as soon as they can, let them start praying. Throw in service projects, church and worship and what it means. When you have your daily devotionals with them, mix all these factors in. By age 10, we might throw in how to manage money on a very elementary scale as a part of our daily faith at home activities. About age 12, in today's age, who knows in the future, but in today's age, it's probably a good idea to cover things like computer, music, and movie boundaries. You know, how far we go and where we go. About age 14, this is where that not anxious approach gets hard. You start talking about dating and kissing and stuff. And about age 16 to 18, you're looking into the future. Looking on into the future, what's to come. So how can the church strengthen their families? Do families need any help? Well, I think we would agree that most of them do. Again, the survey by the Search Institute found the following. Only 12% of teens have a regular dialogue with mother on faith life issues. Only 12%. It's not very many. Only 5% of the teens had a regular dialogue with their father. Half of what it is with the mother on faith issues at home. Only 9% have experienced regular reading of the Bible and devotions in the home. Only 9%. Only 12% have experienced a servanthood event with a parent as an act of faith. I think based on that data and probably on our casual observations that we can say without a doubt that at least some of the families need the church's help in fulfilling this responsibility of nurturing faith at home. So what can we do? We make people aware of the value of their efforts. It works. Do it. We can help make families aware of God's plan for that work. We can equip families to effectively teach faith in age-appropriate ways. And we motivate families to be consistent in their efforts. And that's what we plan on doing in our family ministry. A strong family is a family that picks you up when everybody else is putting you down. A strong family encourages you when everybody else is discouraging you. A strong family forgives you when everybody else condemns you. A strong family accepts you without necessarily approving of all that you do. A strong family loves you without ignoring your faults and in spite of your faults. Even when others consider you to be unlovable. Successful coaches are passionate about their players lifting weights and conditioning. Fans expect them to be passionate. Why? Because coaches and fans know that victory depends in large part upon strength and conditioning. Parents and grandparents should also be passionate about strengthening the faith of our children and grandchildren when they're young. That's the off season. Why? Because true victory in life, when they get to the time of temptations, when they get to the time when they're the most vulnerable, true victory at that point depends on the strength of their faith. That strength and durability is best developed intimately, daily, and faithfully by real life where there are fewer masks. And we've seen tonight that God intended faith to be grown primarily in the family group, like a team, and also in the church, the spiritual family group, which is also a team. In a healthy family, there's honest intimacy, there's communication, there's encouragement, but there's also accountability. In a warm, friendly incubator of love, faith is hatched and grown one day at a time. Away from that environment, our children are going to find that they're surrounded by elements that are cold and that are hostile to the growth of their faith. I hope each of us tonight appreciate the great opportunity that we have, and I pray that all of us will take advantage of that opportunity.